I don't know how far you progressed in the book of Genesis last time. Did you get to any particular series of verses that you finished, Mr. Dart? Still starting. All right. We're still in the beginning in the book of Genesis. Let me just begin by asking, are there any questions from the previous two studies that we've had so far on the book of Genesis? Mr. Dart and I talked on the telephone, and he said that he'd gone through a little bit of the Halley's Handbook, and I had been looking into my Angus Bible Handbook this morning about the origin and preservation and transmission of the text and some of the more technical aspects of it. Are there any questions held over from last time that anyone has at all? All right, well, I'd like to have some participation today, if we could. So maybe we could ask some of you to help me to, first of all, prove in the first chapter of Genesis that these are literal 24-hour days in the creation week. Because, you know, there are many churches that claim that each day is 1,000 years. As a matter of fact, I believe some church organizations believe that the 7,000 year is not even here yet. I'm not certain, but I believe that Jehovah's Witnesses take that view, and that we are now in the 6,000th year of creation, as it were, and therefore there's no requirement to keep the Sabbath day because it hasn't even come yet, and the Sabbath is only in a 1,000 year millennial sense. Would anyone here like to volunteer how you, if you were asked that question of another member or someone, how would you prove that these are literal days in the same sense that a day is a day today? Anyone have any ideas? Maybe I can trigger a thought. Yes.
You said this is the morning and the evening.
Exactly.
The
right. Precisely, because it says the morning and the evening, verse 5, were the first day. Now, a morning is at sunrise, and an evening is at sunset. And it's talking about a light period and a dark period, because it says in verse 5, God called the light day, and the darkness he called night, and the dawning and the sunset, or the advent of each of these periods of time, light and darkness, he called the first day. So it is a physical day. Now, Jesus said in the New Testament on one occasion, we know a day hath 12 hours, because he was talking about the daylight part of a day in which a man may work. And he said, the night cometh when no man may work. And he was talking about the daylight part of a day. But there's another way to do it, too, and that's the Hebrew word yom, Y-O-M, which does mean, in the Jewish encyclopedia, a full 24-hour day. And we covered in some great detail how in the first few verses, it should read in verse 2, the earth became without form and void. And there is a key text on that. Does anybody remember where it was? Where you can go back into the Old Testament, the book of Isaiah, it's 45 and verse 18, and it says, it was not created, tohu, but was created to be inhabited. Yet here it says, the world or the earth was tohu. Now here in an internal text of the Bible, for internal criticism, one way to prove the Bible, one is contextually. One is to find out to whom was it written, to look at all the surrounding verses, to go to other verses and other books of the Bible and so on. And this case, in both Isaiah 45:18 and in 1 Corinthians 14:33, God is not the author of tohu or confusion, the equivalent in the Greek. So the world became without form and void. And we went back to Isaiah 14 and Ezekiel 28 and went through the entire story of the rebellion of Satan the devil and the creation of the present day astronomical and solar systems that we know out there. And as we commented then, what you're looking at is solar and space junk. The moon totally obliterated, and Saturn and Venus and Jupiter and Mars, all of our space probes that are showing absolutely uninhabited, waste, desolate planets with huge craters sometimes hundreds of miles across. And you're looking at space debris that is the result of a gigantic struggle between titanic forces, who knows how many billions of years ago. All right, to get down to the creation week, in verse 2, the earth became without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God brooded over, is the accepted, or pondered, or thought about, moved upon the face of the waters. And God said, now we know that is the word Elohim, that means more than one. It should really read correctly, the family of God said. or the members of the Godhead said. And if we look at John 1, the Logos, or the spokesman, was the member of the God family who did the talking, who did the commanding, and really the person who said, "Let there be light," is the very individual who became Jesus Christ in the New Testament. So God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. Now, in the original, there are some tenses of the verbs here that show you that you are involved in a recreation of the surface of the earth, and not the bringing into existence from nothing of the sun and all the planets and the moon at this moment. And we're going to see that as we go along. God saw the light, that it was good, and God divided the light from the darkness. And God called the light day, and the darkness he called night, and the evening and the morning were the first day. And God said, "Let there be an expanse," or a firmament, "in the midst of the waters, and let it divide the waters from the waters." And God made the firmament and divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament, and it was so. Now you think, as you begin to read verse 6 and 7, it's talking about the earth or the continents, the landmass of Asia, of the United States, South America, of course North and South America, and Australia. You're not. You're reading about waters below the firmament and waters above the firmament, and it was so. And God called the firmament heaven. Now, does that give you any kind of a clue? And it does me, and I think that there again, it's a kind of a far-out thought, but I believe that there is some merit to it, both in the case of where you got all the water at the time of the flood, and in several other aspects of the nature of man, the nature of animals, the lifespan of man, and what the Bible says about the Garden of Eden, that God provided a mist to go up and to water the earth, and that rain came down in a different form than it does today. Now, we all know what causes the weather, and we know it has to do with a combination of the currents of the ocean. It has to do with changing pressure and temperatures, which cause, of course, thermals and causes the air to rush in a certain direction. It has to do also with the orbital pattern of the Earth, and it has to do with the magnetic poles. If you go into the southern hemisphere, I think you all have heard that if you pull a stopper out of the bathtub, the water is going to go in a counterclockwise direction. Where in this hemisphere, it will go in a clockwise direction. As a matter of fact, there's a little bit of information on that in the book of Job and also in Solomon's writings, in the Proverbs, where apparently Solomon was quite an observer of nature. And generally, if you had a globe, you could look at it, and you could see that the doldrums, or those areas right around the equator of the earth, are where the winds from the South Pole and the North Pole are rushing along the surface. They come to the equator, and then they rise, and they are dramatically cooled, and then in jet streams they flow generally back toward the polar regions, where they come down again and are super chilled and flow along the surface of the earth until are heated at the equator, where they rise again. So there is even that motion of the winds of the earth. Now, because the world is turning at the same time, and because there is the action of the moon upon the earth and the sun while it turns, as well as the temperatures or the thermals, there are also all kinds of local and national, and you can see these satellite pictures, and you can see the flow of masses of clouds and gigantic storms which can sweep clear across the country. And we're just now beginning to understand meteorology with the advent of weather satellites, where in previous years, even in World War II, men did not understand it in the way that they can today. Now, on the Earth's surface, most that affects the weather has to do with ocean currents. You've probably heard of the Japanese current. Frankly, if it were not for the Japanese current, much of British Columbia and all of Alaska would be virtually uninhabitable. But because there's some very warm waters that go completely from the depths of the trenches off Japan and flow through the South Pacific and back right along down off of Mexico and flow right up along the California coast and the Oregonian coast, that affects that part of the weather. Now, when it talks about a firmament in the midst of the waters, and it says the firmament divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament, what you're dealing with is moisture or waters or vapor in the air, and the heaven, it says, divides it. God called the firmament, that which divided water from water, heaven. Now, are you or are you not dealing then with an almost Venusian type atmosphere, but instead of being gases, as they think it is true on Venice, of a greenhouse-like effect in the pre-Noachian period of time, from Adam to Moses, where the sunlight was filtered in a far greater fashion than it is today, where the harmful ultraviolet rays that directly affect man and that affect plants and can be absorbed, and we talked about that in carbon-14, changed to carbon-12, as it gradually gives off through its half-life of 5,750 years. If you remember, we were going through that the last time I was here, and how they can determine that there is radioactivity in plant and animal tissue alike. Now, if there was not that same rate of intake of radioactivity, I'm wondering, did it affect the nature of animals, and did it affect the lifespan of man and animals alike? Again, it's just speculation. That's not dogma or doctrine, but it's something that perhaps we can think about. So there is water under the earth. Remember that God said that in the Bible, and of course now we know that that is true. There are whole rivers that flow underneath the rocks. The crust of the earth, relatively, is, and we've talked about this before, is actually thinner than the lacquer that covers the finish on a desk-sized globe. And man has never drilled down, even remotely, beneath that lacquer as a matter of comparison. And what is down there in the core, they can only speculate about. Some think it is quicksilver or mercury. They all believe uniformly that it is very heavy, extremely heavy, and the heaviest substance we know of is mercury, and so on. So because of a combination, if I had a blackboard I could show you, of a study of earthquake waves and seismology, they've determined that the core of the earth may be just molten, hot metal, but metal which is able to absorb shocks and to almost gyroscopically achieve an equilibrium and to continue the rotational pattern and to keep the earth comparatively round. The way they do that is if you had a globe, there are only three ways that earthquake waves travel. If you have an earthquake over here, and you have a reporting station clear over here, eventually the surface waves are going to ripple all the way around the earth on the surface and reach and gently rock a little, the counter that they use, I've forgotten the name, anyway, half a world away. Another method in which they travel is by direct line of sight. So far as you're not going through the core, if you're going through like the top part of it, an earthquake wave would go directly through. Another wave is they go down and up and back and bounce like that. But they never go straight through. They're somehow absorbed by the soft surface, or the core, rather, of the earth. Now, in verse 8, God called the firmament heaven, and the evening and the morning were the second day. And God said, let the waters under the heaven be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear. And it was so. And God called the dry land earth, Hebrew Eretz, and the gathering together of the waters he called seas, and God saw that it was good. Now again, if I had a blackboard, I could explain it, or with a globe very briefly, but a lot of people are convinced that the continents used to be one solid land mass, and that they've been expanded. And there again, if I had a blackboard, I could show you the idea of the plates, as they're called, of the mantle of the earth, or the crust of the earth, under which is molten basaltic rock, and that these, you probably heard a little bit about the principle of isostasy, or isostatic force, but that the continents basically are floating. It would be like we had if I had a blackboard again, I could show you that proportionately to the higher mountain peaks, they believe that the depths of the rocks beneath the surface of the earth as they float are exactly proportionate. In other words, that Everest, where Mount Everest is in the Himalayas, will be the thickest possible part of the crust of the earth. But when you come down now and you get into the ocean beds, and you come way down underneath into the ocean, sorry, I didn't mean to gesture that violently, and you go down about 5 miles and you're in the abyssal depths of the ocean, that the crust of the earth is much thinner there. I don't know what happened, but years ago I had heard that they had a couple of attempts to actually bore out into the ocean at some depths, and there was an attempt, another one called Operation Mole Hole, and they were trying to bore down deeper than they'd ever gone before. I guess some oil wells are clear down. What is the deepest, anybody know? I think some of them go down as much as 2, 3, 4, 5 miles deep, do they not? Thousands and thousands of feet deep underneath the crust of the earth. So, if you look at a map of the way Africa bulges out, and then you look at the way the Gulf fits, and then South America, and it's the way it shoulders out into the Atlantic and then comes in as it goes down from Brazil toward Uruguay and Argentina, you could take those two continents and push them together and they would look like they fit, just like a jigsaw puzzle. And then when you look at the tremendous cracks, have you ever seen the National Geographic map of the floors of the ocean? Well, there are long lines, and they're just about like that brick wall back there. They're tremendous fault lines, and they're in an incredibly symmetrical order. And they have determined this now by soundings as well as by actual observations in bathyspheres and so on. So there are tremendous faults and fault lines that are visible on the floors of the ocean. And it's almost, if you follow my analogy, like a woman that has had a baby. It's like you're looking at stretch marks. And like the world, literally, it's very thin, but that these continents have been pulled apart at some time in the past. Now, we've talked about that before, and I gave you the title of a book that is called Evolutionary Geology and New Catastrophism by George McCready Price. The difference in those two titles is obvious. Evolutionary geology, as you know, says that all life as we know it today is the result of happenstance and accident over vast aeons of time, gradual changes as different adaptations and evolutionary adaptations and so on occurred. Where, quote, new catastrophism, end quote, means just what it says, that there have been gigantic catastrophes of a fairly recent date. And new catastrophism has billions of cubic yards and countless hundreds of billions of tons of evidence, where evolutionary geology has nothing but theory to go upon. Now, all of you, whether you have ever studied geology or not, have seen evidence of gigantic catastrophes as you drive along and you look at the surface of the earth. If you've ever seen the Grand Canyon, if you've ever been to the Rocky Mountains, you ever been to Banff in Alberta, you ever even been to the Appalachians or the Great Smokies, if you've seen cut banks along rivers where you've seen solid rock that has been tortured and that has been folded and has been twisted and different fault lines where great slippages and great eruptions of mountain ranges have taken place and so on, you've seen evidence of catastrophism. And I've mentioned certain other very great deposits of former marine and land life. Now, for example, I think you all know about the Pennsylvania coal mines, and that coal is very commonplace all around the earth. Coal belongs to the Carboniferous, a part of the Cenozoic era, or the Middle Ranges, as they have it in their charts. And all coal or Carboniferous deposits are basically non-radioactive. They're quite ancient, apparently. But I was rereading a little bit this morning, and they claim that it takes 100 feet thick floating vegetable material in the form of tree trunks and limbs and boughs and branches and bodies of animals and men and whatnot and so on to be pressed down into a seam of coal 10 feet deep and, of course, or thick. Now, there are coal mines where you'll go down several thousands of feet and there is coal all the way to the surface. And they go through shale and maybe pyrite and maybe various conglomerates and iron clays and sandstones and more shale and coal. And then some more of these rocks and coal. And sometimes, and where I hunt in Colorado, there is coal right visible on the surface of the earth. There are many coal mines and a lot of strip mines in the area up there. And it can be paper thin. You can see a sandstone and little thin lines of coal and then sandstone and coal. Sometimes it'll be about a few inches thick and sometimes just like a little thin line of vegetable material that was laid down there and then pressed and the water gradually squeezed out because the rocks are porous and then it hardens and becomes the various hardnesses. There are soft coals and very hard coals. Now, we all know that coal is ancient life. Many of you have perhaps seen fossils in museums, and you maybe have seen a piece of black coal where the most beautiful imprint of a fern is visible. And the finest, delicate little leaves are very visible on a piece of coal. And they know, too, that the trapped bodies of animals and men in porous rocks, or animals, they assume men because we find bones of fossil men, but not in the profusion that we do, animals. Now, you're naturally going to find, and you do in the rocks and in the fossils, far more creatures of the sea than you will land mammals, and then, of course, you're going to find fewer men and man fossils than you will animal fossils, and that's precisely the way you do find it. Well, in many of these burial areas underneath the rocks, as the decomposing bodies began to gradually percolate through the rocks, they formed into pools, and those pools then would gradually continue their decomposition process, and sometimes the vapors from those formed gas. And so you have buried thousands of feet deep right here in Texas and right underneath us, no doubt, and up here at Kilgore. Again, a former teeming world that was filled with life of all forms that was buried deep beneath the surface of the earth. And you have oil, which is vegetable and animal material, especially fish and so on, that we use today in petroleum and natural gas. Now, there are no new oil deposits being formed today. There are no new coal deposits being laid down. All of that was done anciently in the past. Now, can you think of examples in geology of absolute proof that these creatures were buried suddenly and that they were buried alive? I've already given you some. Just think about it. Whether you're talking of flora or fauna, doesn't matter. Animals, fish, or you're talking of vegetable material. Can you prove that they were buried alive? Just think it through, and you'll come up with it. Anybody like to volunteer at least one proof you think of? There are all kinds of them. All right, what about that fern I talked about in coal? How carefully would you try to preserve a beautiful fern that you take out of your lawn if you put it in your encyclopedia? You say, isn't that a lovely fern? I'm going to press that. I'm going to keep that, like people have pressed a rose or something like that. Well, now, if you don't do that, and even if you do, it isn't preserved as well as it is in that piece of coal, as it is in that piece of rock, as a fossil. I mean, microscopically preserved, beautiful replica of the real thing, but now gradually turned to stone because it was buried. So it had to be buried alive, didn't it? What happens if it dies? Well, it curls up and gets all brown and just disintegrates and goes back into the soil. What happens if it is washed down a stream and buried along the edge of the stream somewhere? Same thing. It's going to decompose. If it is exposed to the elements for practically any time at all after it is uprooted or buried, it is going to decompose. And because we find billions of tons of these materials that do not show decomposition, but show the imprint of exactly the way they were in life, your only solution is they were buried alive. Now, the same thing is true of fish, shellfish, and even mammalia and land animals and so on. You've all heard me talk about Pompeii. I know Mr. Dart has been there, and I have. My wife has, his wife. Maybe there's some others in this room who've been to Pompeii. And did any of you go to see the Pompeii exhibit in Dallas? Did they have some of the bodies there? Would you describe what you saw, the bodies, what they looked like?
They have a body of a lady and a dog. And the lady had her skirt up over her head. She's trying to shield some of the cinders out of her face. And the dog was all contorted, obviously, in pain. And it was just, instant.
Now, they were fossilized, but in a different way. What happened? They were buried by ash, very light ash and gases. And these people all, and the dogs, suffocated to death. But gradually over the years, as it rained and so on, and here was a city buried under who knows how many dozens or whatever, hundreds of feet of this ash, that ash becomes a kind of a stone that is marketed commercially called pumice. It's a volcanic ash. It's very porous. It's the only rock that floats. If you ever in your high school days had somebody tell you that there's a kind of a rock that floats, well, that's true. It's a lava that comes from both, drifts down in the form of ash, or a foam that then crystallizes, and because it's filled with air pockets, it will actually float. So as they're excavating, they kept falling through, and they thought, what is this? And they found these bones. So I've explained it before. They cut a little hole, pour it full of plaster of Paris, wait till the plaster of Paris hardens, then they excavate very carefully around it, and presto, they have the mold of the form of a body of even a woman, as he said, showing that she was trying to prevent herself from suffocating by pulling her skirt up around her face to breathe air for as long as she could. There's absolute proof she was buried alive, isn't it? And the contorted form of that dog is absolute proof he was buried alive. Now, when you find the same thing in solid rocks by the billions, a swimming fish still in a swimming motion, but then later on pressed flat because of the weight of billions of tons of rocks upon them, in shales and sandstones, very hard rock and so on, and you'll find sharks in a swimming position. So they had to be buried alive. If a shark just dies, it bloats, it'll start to float, what'll happen to it? Other sharks will eat it. Other fish will eat it. It'll be completely torn apart. If a whale or a shark washes ashore and it's dead, the birds are going to pick over it. and the tides are going to act upon it, and it will completely decompose. If you have the whole body there with the entire vertebra and all the ribs and all the structure and all the teeth and the skin and the fins and the swimming motion, it was buried alive. So you see, these many books, and many of them have been done by people of like Seventh-day Adventist faith. For example, George McCready Price is a leading Adventist teacher, and I think he may still be alive. Nelson, I've forgotten his first name, who wrote After His Kind and The Deluge Story in Stone. There is a fabulous book put out by a couple of Presbyterians, as I recall, on the subject of the Genesis flood. And it's put out, I think, by a Presbyterian publishing house. So this is not information that is uniquely the province of the Church of God at all, but it's quite widely known as a proof that God exists and the Bible is His Word and that evolution is not true. Well, let's go on with this and let me see what time I've got here. Keep my eye on the time. Any questions so far up to this point? Contributions? All right. In verse 10, the Hebrew word, remember, is Eretz, the earth. God called the dry land earth, and the gathering together of the waters called He seas, and God saw that it was good. And I've commented in the past, maybe a little sarcastically, that some of these things, such as the sun is still the sun, and the moon is still the moon, and the earth is still the earth, and the seas are still the seas, are some of the few things that man has not tried to change that God said. God called it that, and thankfully man still calls it that today. And God saw that it was good. And God said, let the earth bring forth grass, the herb yielding seed, and the fruit tree yielding fruit after His kind. Interesting key right there. And I think several more things to talk about. Number one, question. How did God create these fabulous trees, herbs, ferns, palm trees, everything from sea anemones and creatures such as urchins and trilobites on down to great whales and even man? How much time did it take him? It's a good question, I think. We've talked about this in the past, but since there's no problem for the world to be 4.5 billion years of age, let's just put it this way. How much time does it take you to come to learn as much as you can come to know, and even then you'll have to admit you don't know very much, about the digestive system of a mosquito? Now, you could make that as a project. You could go home and you could get your hands on all encyclopedias you could find and see if there are certain special books that have been, you know, doctors' treatises or what have you that have been done in the past by certain people who were studies of insects and so on. And I'm sure there may be whole books just on mosquitoes and all the thousands of varieties of mosquitoes and the way they function, the way they work, how they lay their eggs, the way the little larvae act, how they feed, what they eat upon, their digestive and circulatory system, the way their little old jaw cranks out so far that it can sting you clear through your pant legs, and so on. And how long would it take you to learn all about that little critter and how he functions? Well, now, how long did it take a mind that is a vastly superior mind to ours, of course, to sit down and think it out and design it and then bring it into being by creating it? Did God just kind of wave the magic wand in the air and then boom, all of these thousands, millions of creatures and species were created? Or did it take time? Not just my opinion, but I believe that there were billions of years in which the most interesting discussions and ideas were talked about and were mused over and pondered by the archangels and by the members of the family of God, God family, that is the Father and the Son. And I even think that some of those angels may have had input in the creation of some of the creatures, because there are heavenly hosts. And those heavenly hosts consist of more than just human forms, don't they? They consist of beast-like creatures as well as horses. You see heavenly horses in the Bible revealed. I mean, literally, they saw the horsemen. And remember what it was? Elisha said, the chariots of Israel, the chariots of Israel, the chariots of the God of Israel, rather, and so on. And that's, they take the old Negro spiritual swing low sweet chariot from the manifestation of the fiery chariot and the horses that came to spirit Elijah away to a place of safety somewhere. Now, you see cherubim, and they look like men, lions, eagles, and oxen. And the seraphim of the sixth chapter of Isaiah have six wings and are serpentine. And it's interesting that in the Hebrew language, the word saraph, S-A-R-A-P-H, saraph, and seraph, S-E-R-A-P-H, are almost identical. And that Satan the devil is called a dragon in Revelation 12 and verse 9. He is called the cherub that covereth on one occasion, and don't ask me to explain that, I don't really know. But on the other hand, Jesus said in Luke 10:18, I saw Satan as lightning fall from heaven, and when he appeared to Adam and Eve in the garden, he appeared in serpentine form, but standing upright, apparently, like a Tyrannosaurus or like a dragon would appear, rather than as a little garter snake or a red racer would appear, but more like a serpentine form, standing upright, with legs. So it makes me wonder, and this is again just speculation on my part, since the curse that came on the earth after original sin ushered in to the creation of God thorns and thistles, and ushered in the fact that snakes crawl on their belly, and since it was not until after the flood that God allowed the remainder of the nature of animals to change, and what had been herbivores, including lions, tigers, cheetahs, lynxes, bobcats, etc., now became carnivores, man's lifespan, which went almost to 1,000 years, was now shortened to an allotted span of 70 years after the deluge. Was it then that that gigantic expanse of moisture or vapor or water came down to the earth, as well as breaking up the fountains of the deep, and because now the weather patterns that we have today? Then came the division of the continents. Then came the raising of the mountain masses. Then came the creation of ocean currents and the violent weather and the storms that are affected by all of those phenomena today, and the changing of the lifespan of man and the nature of animals. I think that that is so. Don't ask me to prove it, but I think that that is valid. I think that there's every reason to believe that that is true. But back to my subject, why is it that evil spirits are likened, especially in the book of Revelation, I saw two spirits as frogs and so on come out of the mouth of the beast and the false prophet. Why are they likened to creepy, crawly, slimy amphibians and snakes and lizards and frogs? Demons and demonic life are always portrayed as weird-looking creatures of some sort, having a beak and some claws, and you see some of the covers that people will, you know, some of this wild art to illustrate science fiction. And in my own mind, when I go back and I look at some of the great museums, like the Louvre and so on in Paris or in Madrid, and go up to El Escorial and see some of the great paintings, they're as big as this stage, and it will show crazy-looking creatures literally pulling the entrails out of a man, this weird demonic art that they did clear back in the Dark Ages and so on. And in my own opinion, I believe that that is demon-inspired art, and I think that demons have inspired human artists to actually portray caricatures of themselves. So I'm just speculating now, but I am speculating that some of the good creatures of the earth, maybe like horses and eagles and oxen and so on, might have been designed by input from the archangels of like Gabriel and Lucifer, the 24 elders, and some of the other hosts. And what is their job? Are they not counselors with God? There are 24 elders that are pictured sitting alongside his throne. What do these elders do? They're spirit beings. I don't think they come from an earlier creation or an earlier world or an earlier human form. And yet they have a function. They do something. So I'm just speculating again, but I'm wondering if God, the family of God, reserved for themselves the creation of man and woman, and maybe most creatures or whatever, but that certain of these angelic beings had input into the creation of things such as frogs and snails and snakes. And I'm wondering about the age of dinosaurs and the age of some of those weird-looking creatures that inhabit the earth back when Satan the devil, who was then Lucifer, was in charge of the earth in an earlier time before the destruction of the surface of the earth and the burial of all the oil fields and the coal beds that produced the stored fossil life for us today. Again, just speculation. But it says that the earth brought forth grass and the herb yielding seed after his kind. And I've always thought that maybe God took millions of years in planning and in thinking out exactly how the sap was going to flow and how the seeds would be produced. And there, what a study. You know, it's unbelievable. Every life form has its own story to tell. And you can start reading about fungi or about moss or about algae, or you can read about certain pod type seeds, for example, in flowers. And you can hear them pop And that's the way that seed is scattered. Then there's the maple tree that has a little wing on the seed. And in the breeze, it goes like a little whirligig or a helicopter and will go and be carried. Then there's the dandelion, and the wind will carry it away like a little miniature parachute, and it will go on winds for miles to plant this seed. And then there's some little seeds that have been given little husks that are so hard that when birds eat them, they survive the digestive tract, and water birds that feed on these aquatic plants will then take these seeds and actually spread them hundreds of miles away. And every different herb or tree or fern or piece of vegetable matter has its own story to tell about how it survives. The temperature ranges, the elevation or the altitude at which it will be found, the type of salinity in the water that it can stand, whether it likes shade or likes the sun or what have you. Mr. Phillips?
Wouldn't this be another proof, because of the need of insects for propagation and everything, where they were not created until the fifth day?
I think so, yes. Uh-huh.
How could these things last for 2,000 or 3,000 years without the birds and the insects?
Very good point. We used to bring that up in second year Bible class, that because you have the creation of the herbs and the fact that they have to be pollinated, and they have to go through cycles of going to seed and then lying dormant and then coming back and so on, or else they cannot survive, that without the creation of insects and these abundant winged creatures and so on later on, you could not have the propagation of all of the herb life or the plant life. So that's another proof that it had to be a 24-hour day, and a very good one. Okay, now verse 12, and the earth brought forth grass, and the herb yielding seed after his kind, and the tree yielding fruit whose seed was in itself after his kind, and God saw that it was good. And I think that after his kind is a tremendously important principle in plant as well as animal and in human life. It cannot be broken. Now there can be cross-pollination, and there can be infinite variety within a kind. But a rose is a rose is a rose. It's a little bitty wild pink rose, the wild roses, or it's a great big red climbing rose. And there are hundreds of varieties of roses. My wife and I bought 9 little rose bushes yesterday that I'm going to try to go and set out tomorrow, because it's that time of the year and we don't have any yet where we live. And each one is a completely different type. Now, I don't know how to crossbreed roses, but I guess they cut them. And they take a portion right near a place where the little shoot would come out, and they very carefully take a little green portion, and they snub the one down against the other and wrap it very carefully, and they let the sap flow from the one to the other, and they can graft in. Most of these roses have roots that are started with any other kind of a fast-growing rose root. And you'll almost always notice, you go to buy a rose, and you're going to buy a big old knobby bulbous root, and then all of a sudden up here is a green stalk about that big, but you can see that that root is much older, and it's been sitting around. They probably have pared that down several different times and then graft in a different variety of rose. We had a peach apricot tree where only half on up at a branch had been grafted, and half of that tree produced peaches, and the other half of it produced apricots in our yard out in Pasadena. But it's still the same family. The peach, the apricot, and the nectarine, and that family of fruit tree are the same. So there is infinite variety in the moth kind, let's say. Infinite variety in the human kind. There are some kinds of animals where, as far as we know, there's only one kind, and we don't have a lot of varieties. Well, there's one mistake on that. I was going to try to pick some bizarre animal and tell you about that, like the rhinoceros. There are two kinds, and there used to be little small ones, and there are some gigantic ones in fossil life. But today there are two, the white and the so-called black rhinoceros, and very, very few. And the evening and the morning were the third day. Now, verse 14, God said, let there be lights in the firmament of the heaven to divide the day from the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and years, and let them be for lights in the firmament of the heaven to give light upon the earth. And it was so. And in verse 16, if you look into the commentaries, you will see that that is in the past tense, that God had made, referring back to the original statement in verse 1, chapter 1, God created the heavens and the earth. God had made, maybe 4.5 billion years earlier, who knows, 2 great lights. The greater light to rule the day, the lesser light to rule the night. He made the stars also. And God had set them in the firmament of the heaven to give light upon the earth and rule over the day and over the night and to divide the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good, and the evening and the morning were the fourth day. Now, to me, that means that this day's creation work had to do with setting the whole thing in motion. And maybe I'm wrong about this, but in my own opinion, the world used to have a completely different orbital path. And the reason I say that is because the greenhouse effect of the Earth in its previous form, prior to the burial of all of these billions of creatures, indicates that the world was uniformly subtropical. Because you find palm trees and tropical vegetation in very far northern latitudes. For example, clear up underneath the tundra and the permafrost in Siberia and in Alaska, you will find tropical vegetation in fossil life, fossil rocks, and so on. So I believe that the tilt of the Earth was rearranged at that time in the creation week, which brought about the freezing of the water, and I think that it further had something to do with that, more in the time of the Noachian deluge than it did even now in the creation week. And I don't profess to understand exactly what God did in every case, but I do know that there are, well, I don't know how many feet. I think that I've heard it said that if the polar ice caps at both the North and South Pole melted, that it would inundate every port city up to 50 or 80 or 100 feet or whatever they have said all around the world, that the oceans would be so full. Now, that means that there is stored water. They determined, by the way, by both drilling and by seismology, that Greenland has an interior basin which is below sea level. And it's a crazy thing, but it is another proof of this principle of isostatic force and the fact that the continents do float. And that is, again, if I had a piece of chalk, I would show you that as the snows and the ice have fallen over the centuries on Greenland, the weight of the ice has been such that it has gradually borne the surface of the land where the rock and the land begins in the continent of Greenland below the shores of Greenland, where the shores, where they have less ice, are actually above sea level, and the interior is below the level of the seas with a huge pack of ice that has weighted it down. So those are just things in passing, but it's interesting the way God has created the Earth and the fact that the Earth apparently has a great deal of water, not only stored on both poles, and that those poles froze and quick froze life forms at a time when God tilted the Earth and caused the present climates as we have them today, which are different from the climate in the pre-Adamic period and very markedly different in the climatic period from Adam to Noah. They're different today after the Noachian deluge. Well, I'm going to stop there because we're getting to about 6 minutes till and take a break and have the children come back in, and then we'll have the worship service this afternoon. And Mr. Ted Phillips is here, as you all know, who is going to become the permanent pastor of the church here in Tyler, and he and his wife are going to be moving down. I know they're looking for a home at the present time. I know all of you are going to be very happy to welcome them to this area, and we're very pleased that this is true because he's going to be able to give his time to spending time visiting with some of you people and others in their homes as they have that requirement and would like to have Mr. Phillips come and talk to them and will be available to really work with the Tyler region, the whole region of Gladewater, Big Sandy, Longview, and the Tyler area. And it's a very happy solution for us, as well as, of course, helping out with the other matters in the ministry and in the office as he can. So the sermon this afternoon will be brought to us by Mr. Ted Phillips. We'll take a break.